Take a network break. Keep your eyes on the road, your hands on the wheel, and your mouth full of virtual donuts as we wade through the summer swamp of tech news. I'm Drew Conrad-Mari. Greg Farrow is here. And Greg, you and I and the rest of the Packet Pushers crew are going to be in at VMworld next week.
Yeah, it's the annual get-together of Packet Pushers, and VMware has decided to ride on top of that and organize their conference.
Very thoughtful of them.
Yeah, all four of us will be getting together to... And so, you know, VMware wants to hold a conference to celebrate us getting together, I think.
Yeah, go ahead and think that.
You see it your way, I'll see it. You know, my universe is far more important than any... No, I'm just joking. No, we're going to VMworld, which is good. We're trying to slow down our travel so we can focus more on the show and learning and doing the Ignition content system, which is takes a lot of time. So, you know, really we're traveling much less this year. VMworld is always a good one to go to. There's the FutureNet conference coming up, so we'll be there on Thursday if you've been lucky enough to receive an invitation and get approved to attend. So we'll be there if you're tuning into this next week while the conference is on. Hey, come and see me on Thursday. But otherwise,
that's right. Yeah. And we'll also be running around the show floor, shooting video and doing reporting and stuff. So if you see us, yeah, feel free to say hi.
Yeah, we thought we'd have a play. The YouTube channel has become a thing. We've got 2,000 subscribers to the YouTube channel. I'm publishing content a little less regularly because it does take quite a bit of time to do a video, come up with some content to record it, and then edit it and then publish it. It's actually quite a time-intensive process. So, and, you know, with other things going on, we've sort of slowed down a little bit. But what we are doing is I'm still going to be publishing, and we're going to try some different ideas about how this might work into the future, about how we could generate content that might be worth doing. So we'll see how that works out.
That's right. And if you want to see the Packet Pushers IRL, as the kids say, then we'll see you in Vegas.
Yeah, we will. We're not doing anything in particular, but we'll be there.
That's right. Let's take care of our business and then we'll jump into the news. Today's show is sponsored in part by IT Pro TV. You can upgrade your career and learn the skills you need to acquire the most in-demand certifications with their engaging online training courses. Just visit itpro.tv/network. And if you use the code NETWORKBREAK, you can try it free for 7 days and get 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And as Greg mentioned, we've got a new subscription site that's at ignition.packetpushers.net. You get exclusive Packet Pushers content. There are free and paid membership tiers. That's ignition.packetpushers.net. All right, to the news. Arista Networks has announced a partnership with VMware. The two companies are going to integrate Arista's CloudVision, that's its management and orchestration software, with VMware's NSX.
Yeah, so we've been talking a lot about cloud networking and how people work in a multi-cloud. So that's on-prem, off-prem, private on-prem, legacy on-prem, as opposed to public off-prem and private off-prem. So private off-prem is colo, obviously. Public off-prem is public cloud with all of the tooling that they give you. And there's all these different types of networks you're going to do to put them together. And I think this announcement isn't just about the VMware partnership, although that's a big part about it. I think we're also seeing a lot of fairly enterprise-specific features come out.
Yeah, there was a lot in this announcement. This was the biggest part, I thought, this partnership with NSX. And what they're doing is they're essentially saying, you've got all these micro-segmentation policies in NSX, but you may have some workloads like a storage area network or a bare metal server that's not on the NSX overlay, and you still want to push security policies out to it. So in NSX, you'll be able to send a policy to CloudVision, which will translate it into something it can instantiate in a hardware ACL, and then put that policy onto a top-of-rack switch.
So now, that's the missing piece of NSX.
Yeah, NSX becomes your policy repository, but it also has that outside the overlay component.
So this is where ACI has been strong in this ability to do like a hardware-defined network and then do a bit of software overlays on top. And we've always talked about when would NSX, you know, do something in the hardware to breach out and embrace the legacy, because, you know, your mainframes and your minis and a lot of your servers are still bare metal and you want to get them in. And I think increasingly, if you've got a big VMware estate, you don't have too many of those bare metal things left.
Probably not a lot, but there's always corner cases.
So what Arista is saying is your NSX policy. Now, just to extend this a little bit, this also plays into the campus. If you think about NSX and Arista having a tie-up or NSX building a policy engine to put, you know, its micro-segmentation into silicon via, in this case, via EOS, there's no reason why NSX can't develop APIs this way and then use them to partner with other companies to put NSX overlays in the campus.
For sure. Yeah, that does seem like a move here.
Because you want to have VMware, obviously, we'll talk about the financial results further down the show order, but Pat Gelsinger was very big on VeloCloud and saying how much growth they're getting out of the VeloCloud SD-WAN acquisition. So it would be a very useful thing for NSX to start reaching out and saying, well, we can stitch together a a zone, you know, zone segmentation or micro segmentation, or as Arista likes to call micro segmentation, macro segmentation, because Arista's always got its own words for everything. You ever heard? Running joke. So I think it would be interesting to see this sort of stuff is a play for Arista to get used to the ideas of what it needs to do a micro seg solution in the campus. And obviously Arista's cloud vision is the existing software platform that comes with it. Part of it was also the fact that they're offering configuration management product on top of cloud vision too, which I thought was interesting.
Right. And a neat element of this is that if you create a policy in NXS and you try to push it out to an Arista switch and CloudVision can't actually execute that policy for whatever reason, if there's some translation issue, it will send a note back to NSX saying, we can't actually do this. You'll have to find a different way.
Yeah, which is useful because if it doesn't work, that's actually more important. Other enterprise-specific features was MACSEC over DCI. So it's very popular for people using data center interconnects. Maybe you've got some 40 gig or 100 gig lines between two fairly regionally close together sites, and people want to encrypt those so that people can't tap them. So the Arista is saying that they're boosting their MACSEC capability. I think I would have thought they'd already had that, but apparently now they're actually saying MACSEC for DCI, which is important. That is obviously a feature that's in the Broadcom silicon, and most emergent silicon has MACSEC capabilities now in the latest generations. And they're now saying they've got a specific platform for that, the 7280R, which I assume has some optical interfaces.
Did
they discuss that?
No, they did not discuss that.
No, I would guess that that's an Ethernet switch has got a couple of long-haul optical interfaces so that you can do your own DCI in a single box without actually flipping out to a DWDM device. And also talking about IPsec acceleration for WAN stuff, so IPsec WAN, so the 7020R. My guess is, again, that this is a version of the Broadcom silicon. I wasn't able to attend the briefing, otherwise I would have asked. But my guess is that most of the modern Broadcom chips have IPsec capabilities to a lesser or greater degree, and they're lighting up this feature in the EOS software that they've got.
Yeah, I asked if they had a specific ASIC or devoting some CPU for this IPsec capability. They said no, it's just running on the standard silicon that's doing everything else as well. So
yeah, the features that are in the latest generations of Broadcom, so this must be a Jericho 2 or a Trident 3 or something, does have quite good IPsec capability. So the crypto is getting into the ASICs. But there's often some flexibility, or there are certain limitations because of the hardware dependency here. So you'll need to do some homework to make sure it fits with your current IPsec strategy. But it is there. So this opens up, obviously, this is a step towards enterprise WAN, just using IPsec. After this would obviously be SD-WAN. It wouldn't be too hard for Arista to add something to EOS to make it an SD-WAN-like solution. Probably would look more like Juniper than VeloCloud or Viptela, if you know what I mean.
And sort of playing on that, one other part of this announcement was, you may remember that Arista has the vEOS. This is a virtual router that you can stick up in the cloud. If you want to segment some VPCs or do inter-VPC interconnectivity, you can do that with vEOS. Now they're saying they've got vEOS available for AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud, and you can have your vEOS routers running across all these different clouds, but using the same policy model, same policy language, all being run through CloudVision.
Yep. Pretty straightforward. And the other interesting one is the cloud security. They're partnering with Zscaler, just like just about everybody else is. Zscaler's in a great position. Everybody's selling their product for them.
Right.
Not an easy product to copy, though. So if you need this, you need this. But it's actually the content inspection and cloud zone security solution that's quite widely used. So it can do all the logging and the interconnection. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out. Obviously, we've seen plenty of other SD-WAN companies like Silverpeak integrate with Zscaler for security scanning and so forth.
That's everybody's favorite partner.
Yeah. And then the final part of the announcement is like they've got an EOS tooling that actually does configuration management, and they're trying to pitch it as a security. Everything's going to be pitched around security. Have you noticed lately? Everything's security.
It's an easy hook.
An easy hook, yeah. And also security, the security marketplace is growing at 20 to 30%. So if you sprinkle some security sauce over your other product, the hope is that...
over your existing product, hey, we're now calling it security.
Yeah, you'll see a lot of that if you look at the announcements coming out. There's a lot of like, oh, we're a security, this is our latest security tool. And you go like, it's just a configuration thing that you should have had 10 when your product shipped.
Right. You mean VLANs? You've already been...
you're giving me a tool so I can check the configuration of my boxes and tell them which are out of support and which devices have known vulnerabilities. That's like, that should have shipped when you shipped your product. I do have a beef about that. A lot of these simple configuration automation tools are actually doing basic stuff that really should have been in the products 10 years ago. So it is funny to me.
Right. That, this new feature of CloudVision where they'll tell you, they'll look at all the software configurations of your EOS routers and switches and say, hey, this one is out of date. This one needs a software patch. I was surprised that they're just getting to that now. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Well, and so is Cisco. So SD Access, this was the key first feature that SD Access was promoting. So if you're a customer and you attend sort of a quick webinar on Cisco's software-defined access in the campus, this is the first feature they talked to you about. Automated updating of firmware, configuration backups, and telling you the status of the support contracts, which is a serious day two time suck. It's a very expensive business operating a Cisco campus because of all of the – it's just a tragedy how difficult it is to manage things via the CLI. And, so, you know, CloudVision does continuous checking of devices, dynamic updates of software, and will remediate failures of the software update process. That's like, duh. So, yeah. Yay. Welcome to 2010. Networking. Yeah. All right.
Well, there was a lot to go over. We'll have a link to the full press release if you want to go in there and get some more details from Arista, but it's time to move on. A Microsoft researcher says the company is going to share its Open Network Emulator software with the community. If you've never heard of Open Network Emulator, it creates a real-time simulation of Microsoft's Azure production network so that engineers can test changes against it so that they don't break things. Microsoft essentially says it runs a virtualized version of each network device in the Azure network and injects the device's real configuration, links those devices into what it calls, quote, an emulation that provides faithful replication of the network control plane and a reasonable approximation of the network data plane. And now they're going to make this software available open source.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? When you're in a work for a big company, it's funny how you can have the left hand and the right hand not knowing they're attached to the same body. So this is great. An open network emulator that works for Microsoft obviously allows you to do software test beds and emulate your network and to do various testing against it. And yet I also distinctly remember talking to somebody from Microsoft saying there's no point in doing test beds and evaluations because when you put the software on the actual devices, it operates substantially differently.
Uh-huh.
The challenge between emulators is that it does allow you to do verification of things like API calls and configuration calls and what your upper level software can do. Or, you know, if I start putting BGP routes in here, it's good at that. But when you put it on the device and then you try to run the same automation against it, and if all of a sudden the device doesn't do it because the silicon doesn't work that way or that the firmware that's on the box is out of date, or, you know, there's a memory leak and there's it can't handle any more BGP routes, or there's some, you know, whatever it is, it can't help you with that. I read this paper and it takes this absolute position that our software is awesome because we can test stuff that's not in live. And I'm going, I've also seen people say there's limitations to what you can achieve in test beds. The only way you can test it is in live. And why they would invent their own instead of working with the existing ones that are out there has got me baffled. Why would they reinvent this wheel? Like EVNG and GNS3, all these tools are out there that do network emulation at scale. I mean, Cisco's got its own, Juniper's got its own. The vendor ones are very expensive. They're not practical for day-to-day use. They're only useful for customers who have specific needs and have loads and loads of money. So I don't recommend the vendor ones. I definitely recommend EVNG. I think at the moment it seems to be the most popular one. But I'm a bit dubious here. I just wonder if Microsoft is producing something and expecting everybody to like it, and it's just not suited to what most people are going to use it for.
Well, it sounds like in the paper that they talked about, they actually specifically mentioned Veriflow, which does a formal verification of the network, and they're also a competitor forward networks. And it sounds like that's where they're trying to position this.
Well, see, the problem is that they're saying like Veriflow can only analyze any network modeling solution can't take advantage of predicting what's going to happen, because by definition, it has to draw data from the network before it can analyze it. So that's not a valid comparison in any way, shape, or form. That technology is never meant to solve that problem. If you're saying I need to increase the availability of my network, then yes, putting things in a testbed helps to increase the availability by working out certain bugs. But it doesn't prevent bugs from still appearing in the live network, where outside of your emulation, the real, you know, you can build an emulation which is a reasonable facsimile of what's in live, but it's not actually live.
Right, of
and
course.
When you go into live, all of a sudden you've got this different network with different inputs and, you know, temporal variations, and it's not stochastic. It's traffic goes up and down. It doesn't match what you're modeling, and all of a sudden it blows up anyway. So I'm not a big believer in test beds. I think they're useful, but they're not what this paper is presenting as a universal panacea. It's just it's a low-value emulation for people who've got plenty of resources and plenty of time to run test beds. I think it's much better to look at a network that runs in live.
Mm-hmm. We've got a whole bunch of links if you want to find out more about this. Although Microsoft hasn't actually said when it's going to make this code available. No word on it yet, just a promise that it's coming.
What it'll look like? What's it going to run on? Is it only going to run on Azure? Is it something that an ordinary person can use? I'm a bit dubious. There's something wrong with this announcement I can't put my finger on, that's all.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. We've got some news about TLS, TLS 1.3. It's the latest version of the Transport Layer Security Protocol that authenticates websites and encrypts traffic. It has been approved by the IETF, and that's got some enhancements to make it all better and more happy.
Yeah, so I've talked a lot about TLS 1.3 because I think it's a substantial transition for networking, particularly public networking on the internet, in that it finally addresses what I see as features that it doesn't patch TLS 1.1 or 1.2 or, you know, SSL 3 or any of those sort of things. It actually puts features in there that should have been in there that people actually knew that should have been there but couldn't 10, 15 years ago. The, you know, CPUs weren't fast enough to do SSL. The software for SSL libraries has advanced out of sight. Weaknesses in crypto have appeared and we have a better understanding of side channel attacks and all these things like Oracle attacks that we've seen consistently on encryption algorithms. It's just so I see this as our whole process is to implement the encryption that we need. And I think people need to take the view that this transition in encryption is an ongoing process. You'll always be moving from TLS 1.3 to 1.4 to 1.5, and it's going to happen regularly. So don't get bent out of shape. You just better embrace it, which is good. It's very much about a speed enhancement, which is very important for mobile devices because the current TLS has a two-step handshake. So it actually does the three-way handshake twice, which means you have to burn a lot of power to set up a TLS connection under 1.2. And also that's very latent. So sending a packet TLS over a mobile phone of limited bandwidth or very high latency bandwidth and having all these handshakes was a good idea back when, but it's not anymore. So you're seeing TLS 1.3 reduces handshake latency, encrypts more of the handshake so that networking corporate surveillance by network carriers, service providers is much harder, much more complex. This is why we saw Verizon buy companies like Yahoo because they knew this was coming. They're going to lose the ability to get useful data out of the network as TLS 1.3. And that, of course, is why Google has been championing TLS 1.3, by the way, because you know, the network providers can't get access to what their customers are getting that data. It's also improving the resiliency to cross-protocol attacks and removing a bunch of insecure legacy features. So the net result here is there's one thing that people haven't solved, and I hope they never do, which is middle boxes, which remain out of scope. So a lot of telcos today put middle boxes in the middle to do stuff to data. Sometimes they're trying to cache it. Sometimes they're trying to replace ads. Sometimes they're just trying to capture, use the data so they can sell it off to ad brokers. With TLS 1.3, it's almost impossible, very difficult. And this is going to implement the biggest impact that I see at the moment is corporate proxies. So financial companies, banks, big corporations who log user traffic. And the other one is virus and malware scanners who often implement SSL proxies in the operating system. And they're going to find it really difficult, if not impossible, to intercept traffic that's TLS 1.3 encrypted. Now, today you can just fall back to TLS 1.2, but I think over time, companies like Google will basically make it very difficult, if not just enforce 1.3 and say, that's it, we're done with the legacy protocols. So if you run a proxy server, that game's probably over.
Okay. Days are numbered. We've got a link to a blog by Cloudflare, which has a really detailed overview of a lot of the crypto issues that TLS 1.3 is fixing.
Yes, it's a great post. And I think it's definitely worth your time sitting down and digging deep into TLS 1.3 because this protocol is going to be the IPv6 of the future because it's going to be the only protocol that we're already seeing DNS over TLS 1.3. So Firefox has an implementation. So you might actually be in a situation where TLS encrypted HTTP is the only protocol. So IPv6 is, you know, all this rubbish that people are going on about IPv6 headers and stuff like that. It's all pointless when everything's just going to be carried in HTTP anyway.
Mm-hmm. All right, a quick break to tell you about today's sponsor, IT Pro TV. Whether you're just starting out or you're a seasoned IT professional, IT Pro TV is the only source you'll need. You can learn the skills to pass the most in-demand certs from entry level to advanced with engaging hosts and a talk show style format. IT Pro TV calls this binge-worthy learning. Their extensive course library includes CEHV9, CISA, CompTIA, Mac Certified Support Professional, and more. And they're recording new content live every day, so you know you're getting the most current IT training. And you don't have to leave home. You don't have to go to a training center. You can stream courses live on demand at your desktop, on a mobile device. They also support Apple TV, Roku, and even Fire TV. So head on over to itpro.tv/network. Use the code NETWORKBREAK and you can try it free for 7 days and get 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. Premium subscriptions, which include unlimited Kaplan practice exams and virtual labs, they're normally $857 a year. But if you use the code NETWORKBREAK, you'll only pay $600 per year. So visit itpro.tv/network and don't forget to use the code NETWORKBREAK. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. All right, moving on, Cumulus Networks, they make the Cumulus Linux Network OS. They have announced that its network operating system can now run on Broadcom's Trident 3 chipset.
So this would be quite a long time since the Trident 3 was announced. Remember we talked about it in Network Break 140? You can tell I looked that up, didn't you?
It says here June 2017.
That's it. I looked it up because I was just thinking how long. So that is over a year since the Trident 3 was announced.
Yeah, I was actually surprised by this release coming out now.
Yes, and so a year later, Cumulus is saying they're adding support for the Trident 3 chipset in its operating system. But my understanding is that shipments of Trident 3-based switches are still fairly limited. So they're not shipping en masse, I don't believe. There's definitely some out there that you can buy. I think that Cumulus might be an early mover here because they're heavily inside of many cloud companies. Not necessarily the very, very big ones, but at the second tier, there's a bunch of them that use Cumulus internally as well as some of the big ones. And so I think that they're going to be one of the first to come out with Broadcom Trident 3, which, you know, sort of tells you that sometime late this year, early next year, the enterprises will be ready to run Trident 3 switches, I would think.
They said switches running Cumulus are going to be available in fall of 2018.
When's fall? Is that autumn?
That's probably, I'm guessing, September, October, November. That's what I would say.
Okay. So for people in Australia, that would be summertime.
Yes. That's
right. I get really bent out of shape when people talk about fall, which is, and that word is only used in America, and I used to live in the Southern Hemisphere. So let's just call it calendar Q4.
That. We shall do that.
Yes, we've got to be sensitive to all cultures, not just, you know, pretend.
All parts of the globe.
Now, one of the interesting things here is, I, as part of preparing for this article, I realized that Cisco has pretty much switched to going with its own ASICs for all of its Nexus switches, Nexus 9000. So all of the switches in the data center for the current generation seem to be Cisco's cloud-scale silicon, which I think is interesting that Cisco sort of used merchant, said we're embracing merchant, and then has switched right the way back to having its own custom silicon for the Nexus 9000 switches. I haven't quite got to the bottom of that, and I think I'll do some more reading and chatting to people about that to find out just how far that goes. It's just interesting to see Cisco turning away from merchant. Maybe they had a negative response from customers, or they found that customers were not perceiving value in Cisco's solution when they were competing equally against merchant. It's just something to think about.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think the cloud or, you know, in particular, their solution, particularly ACI, might not be well suited to the Broadcom silicon, and they feel they have to build a custom ASIC to give ACI the capabilities. Plenty of people tell me that ACI struggles to use normal silicon because of the way it uses the TCAMs and quickly runs out of resources. So we'll see.
That would be a good reason to do it themselves.
Yeah, they might want to. I got an idea that their cloud scale silicon is actually an OEM of someone else's, and I don't know who, but I feel like they've got a chip from somebody else and they've just done some tweaking of it to add extra memory or, you know, features that they think are relevant and then called it their own. But I'm not entirely sure that Cisco's doing a ground up design of the cloud scale.
Well, I guess if you have a tip, you can find Greg on the internet or on our Slack channel and
let him know. I'd love to hear more about that and what the background is behind that.
All right, moving on. SD-WAN software, we talked about that all the time. Software and hardware sales are predicted to have a compound annual growth rate of 35% over the next 5 years. That is according to a report from Dell Oro. The company predicts that software components are going to drive growth and that over time, hardware will become commoditized and enterprise purchases are going to drive the majority of these sales as opposed to service providers.
Now, that's quite contentious, that last statement there, that they think that enterprises will buy this and not manage service providers, because the discussions that you and I have had with SD-WAN companies has very much been, we see managed service providers as being key markets for us.
Well, they're not saying it's not going to be no service providers, but just most of the sales, I think 60% for enterprise and 40% for service provider. So not a huge split, but majority yes for enterprise. And I kind of agree with that.
Yeah, I think a lot of companies basically, you know, my working hypothesis is that most people found operating a WAN to be unbelievably painful and unbelievably difficult. Yeah. And they found it easier just to give the problem to somebody else and pretend it's not something that's their problem. And these managed service providers moved into that gap and they're making buku bucks out of that, like by provisioning WANs and putting routers on the end of it and then pretending that it's mystic magic, you know. I think SD-WAN, however, changes that game. Those managed service providers will adopt it, but not for the reasons that you think, because quite often the managed service providers got locked into one or two telcos to buy bandwidth from.
Right.
And they couldn't be with more than one or the other because they couldn't accrue discounts on the bandwidth. And it's a scale game. The more bandwidth you buy, the bigger your discounts and the more your profit margin grows. And SD-WAN changes that all around, where an enterprise can really, in my view, operate a WAN quite cheaply if they choose to do so. But managed service providers, of course, can deploy an SD-WAN portfolio and use anybody's bandwidth. So they lose their dependency on the telco that, you know, if telco A is not giving them a good deal on bandwidth or is not located where the customer needs bandwidth, they can just go and use anybody and start using public WAN instead of private WANs. My belief is that most enterprises will switch to SD-WAN very quickly because there's very good ROI, and managed service providers will find that threatening, and so they'll be forced to switch. So that's why I think SD-WAN will grow very quickly.
Well, Del Oro is putting the total market size at $2.2 by the year 2023. IDC is saying $4.5 by 2022, so a couple of competing numbers there, but sort of generally in the same ballpark.
I've got an idea that last prediction we saw was $20 by 2022.
Yeah, a little overstatement.
I thought that I just seem to remember some really like tens of billions of numbers for the SD-WAN market back in wherever. Oh, here we go. So in April 2017, Gartner was predicting it will be a $1.1 billion market by 2020. Gartner's not very good at predicting numbers. Don't rush about that. I don't believe this is anything that I'd pay attention to. Yeah.
We can split the difference and say a $3 billion market maybe.
Yeah, here we go. IDC says it's a $6 billion market by 2020.
Okay, so we're revising down a little bit.
No one knows. Yeah.
Right. Well, it's an estimate. It's a guess.
Yes.
All right. We've talked about Huawei and ZTE having problems with the U.S. government. Now, Australia is blocking the use of equipment from Huawei and ZTE in its 5G networks. This is according to news reports. The Australian government has extended national security rules that usually apply to carriers. They're not going to be applied to equipment makers. For its part, Huawei released a statement saying that it had never been asked to engage in any intelligence work by any government.
It's funny how companies say we didn't, you know, like as a company, we've never been asked, but it never validates that its employees aren't necessarily co-opted by state actors.
Well, there's that. And also, there may be a difference between asked and ordered as well.
Yeah, all sorts of semantic. Now, Australia's been telegraphing this and telling people for a long time that they're very concerned about this. This should be no surprise to anybody that this has come up. Australia obviously is part of the Five Eyes consortium, and they have been saying for quite some time that they're very concerned about Huawei and ZTE in the telco backbone of the country, and they've obviously taken rather extreme action to lock them out. Now, most of the telco infrastructure in Australia is actually owned as a group, so that is, it's not unlike the US market, for example, where the telcos like Verizon and AT&T have their own networks and they own the towers and they own the networks that connect them all together. The Australian market, like most of the rest of the world, is there are companies who put the infrastructure in the towers, and then there are other companies who run the bandwidth, and then there are retail telcos who then sell that to the consumer. So there's brands like Telstra and Optus and, you know, all that, whoever it is that's down there now, they've changed a lot. They actually have either stakes in the companies that have the telephone towers or stakes in the companies that have the bandwidth, but they don't own them themselves. They all share the infrastructure, if you like, and then they spend time and money selling their brand, which is a perfectly reasonable way to do it. And so the Australian government maintains quite a lot of control. They believe it to be critical infrastructure, so they're dictating what equipment. They're saying just don't use Huawei and ZTE because we believe that's a reasonable threat to national security.
Yeah, though I should note one of the stories reported that Australia's 4G network does include Huawei gear, so I'm not sure what they're going to do about that.
Oh, they'll just, you know, we talked last week, I think, about the British government saying that, you know, a substantial amount of the telco infrastructure is already Huawei, and it's not a situation that we can fix. You know, they think it should be pulled out, but they can't ask the telcos to do that.
Right. Well, that's a situation we're going to be keeping an eye on. Another quick break, I want to tell you or just remind you about our Ignition site, ignition.packetpushers.net. And Greg, you can tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so Ignition is our membership system. Over time, we've been building up a range of newsletters. So we've got the Human Infrastructure Magazine, which comes out every 2 weeks, which is occasionally sponsored. It's an opportunity for us to talk a little bit about being a person in technology. We've got the link propagation, which is a collection of links that we publish weekly. It comes out on a Friday, usually a little email. That's now published as a blog post, and then we send you out a little email. And then we have sort of a couple of other email letters. When you sign up to be an Ignition member, you get to subscribe to all of those newsletters, and you'll be able to see, get participation. You used to be able to sign up to them individually, and now you can join the membership and it automatically subscribes you to both. And then you've got access to some free content. And as we've talked about in the shows previously, we're building a range of content that we can make available to you. I've published one of my ebooks there on my blogging guide. I used to call it my Ask First Guide to Blogging on how to write a blog post. but now I call it my Hasty Guide to Blogging. It talks about a process of how to set up a blog and start blogging, because I'd love to see more of you blogging, perhaps on Packet Pushers, but perhaps on your own blog. And so if you become a member of Ignition, you can go and download that ebook for free and get started on learning how to be a better blogger.
You've also got an ebook on career advice.
Yeah, for premium members, those who've paid up, I've got an ebook which I was I wrote about the sort of collection of the career advice that we've done on Packet Pushers over the years. And I was chatting to somebody who downloaded it last week. His entire team signed up to be Ignition members. And he said, reading your book did give me and my team some great pause for what we're working on how we're being compensated. And since then, we've locked arms and are asking for a plan from the business owner to get a percentage of gross profit as our compensation plans.
Nice.
So it turns out that basically what they're saying is, after thinking about it, they're now realizing that their quality of life is just not good.
They're locking arms. You're getting people to unionize.
Well, I think they just started to think carefully about, you know, how much of their personal life was being sucked into the company. And they realized that for the money that they were being paid, they were overextending themselves. And so that's sort of that's not a very popular worldview. Most people would say you could work harder for your company. And I'm going like, why? That is not a great idea, right? You should be working harder for yourself. And when you work hard for yourself, you expect to get paid for that. And if you're not, then your career plan is not working in the way that I think it should. So that's the sort of stuff I put into the book. Not very popular, some of those opinions, but hopefully they give you pause and challenge the way you your vision of the world and maybe improve your career for you.
That's right. On the premium site, there's also videos. Ethan's working on a course on QoS fundamentals, an educational course, and we'll be adding more content to the premium site as the year progresses. So check it out, ignition.packetpushers.net. All right, we just talked about some problems between Chinese and American or Western countries. We've got a story where they're actually finding a partnership here. This is HPE and Alibaba announcing a deal in which HPE is going to support Alibaba's hybrid cloud software. This is called Apsara Stack on HPE gear that includes ProLiant servers and FlexFabric switches.
That's really interesting, isn't it? It's like this is like an on-premise version of Alibaba's cloud. We've seen a few weeks ago Google Kubernetes Engine, GKE, doing a partnership with Cisco to bring that on-prem. We saw VMware on AWS, and then we've also seen VMware start to do more to bring AWS on-prem. We saw AWS itself introduce its Snowball, and now it's saying you can run servers on the Snowball. They're mostly talking about using the servers in the Snowball box to start doing the workload, sucking in the data to put on it so you don't have to use your in-house compute because you might not have any. And we've also seen a range of other different moves like Azure with its Azure Stack as an app. So Alibaba on-prem, perfectly logical, I guess.
Yeah, I guess this product is being targeted at the Asia-Pacific region, although excluding China, so they aren't going to be selling it in China, but the rest of Asia, so presumably Singapore, Japan, and other parts of the Asia-Pacific region, even Australia. And yeah, I think also an acknowledgement that the Chinese web giants, Alibaba and Tencent in particular, are finding traction outside of China, and this is HPE glomming onto some of that success.
It's pretty easy when you sell lots of servers and, you know, you have storage and switches and stuff like that. This is basically just a hyperconverged stack with Alibaba software on it. Well, that's no different to selling VMware's VxRail or Nutanix's HCI or, you know, Cisco's got 25 different HCI stacks, I think. Why not? These companies have to choose somebody.
Yeah, no word about this partnership being exclusive, so we may see other infrastructure providers getting on board here, but HPE is first out of the gate.
Yeah, quite a win for HPE, though, while Google partnered with Cisco and VMware obviously has managed to get a good deal with AWS so far. Be interesting to see how this works out.
Yep. So financial news, VMware, they've reported their Q2 2019 financial results. They brought in $2.17 billion for the quarter, which is up 13% year over year. And a net income of $644 million.
blindingly good results for VMware, obviously with a great increase in revenue. They, in the analysts chat, I read the transcript of the earnings call, they talked specifically about how NSX and the networking has been a substantial grow for them, which is pretty great. And also this is where they called out that VeloCloud was being a big thing, right? So the new NSXT switch lets them do virtual cloud. So now they can do the transition from on-prem to off-prem, wherever you might be. You don't have to be stuck with bare metal sort of things or a VMware certified cloud. Now I can start to use the NSXT switch to put into instances over on AWS or Google Cloud. I think that he particularly called out how big or how successful the VeloCloud stuff has been, and also how NSX is enabling them to sell pretty big VxRail, like the HCI solution that with Dell that they've put together. So I think there was a drop in the share price. There was a bit of a lull. It fell 3.1%, I think, because people found that some of the forward projections were not great. And I think some people decided to sell out of the stock or people started to take profits, but then the share price has bounced back this morning. So it's a little hard to know.
You know, five-day stock movements don't necessarily tell you a lot about the company's long-term viability.
No, you're right. But usually after you have when you have your financial results, people say it's the forward-looking part. Any change in share price is a measure of future value or not. So they are down 2.9% so far this morning. There has been a drop since the announcement yesterday. But, you know, the VMware share price is up pretty handily over the year. It's up from sort of like $120 to $155. I don't think anybody would be too worried. They'd just be a little bit concerned that maybe VMware is reaching a peak because it's predicting slightly lower numbers for next quarter.
Although it's clear that the networking side of the house with NSX and VeloCloud is a spanking hot growth area for VMware.
Yeah, vSAN and NSX, two spanking growth areas. Obviously, the assumption would be is that ESX is a saturated market. They called out their VMware AWS, but I didn't get the sense. They said they've got like 100 customers or something on VMware on AWS. I don't think it's been the blinding success that they thought. I think they're still struggling to make it work. But I'm sure that their sales force is being getting regular whippings to get out there and get that product sold. Well, that's how enterprise sales works.
The beatings will continue until morale improves.
Yeah, you know, the motivation for enterprise salespeople is indeed strange.
That's right. All right, some personnel news. Facebook has hired Antonio Lucio. He did run HP's marketing team. That's HP, not HPE. And he's now the new chief marketing officer at Facebook.
Yeah, I'm not sure quite how selling laptops and desktops and printers translates into Facebook. But I think the thing that I take out of this is where do the big technology companies get their people from? And the answer is from enterprise IT companies. And a lot of people forget that. They sort of think that people who work at Facebook or Google or any of these big technology companies, Alibaba, are all got special magical properties for their technology. And 9 times out of 10, they're just hiring people and giving them permission to be awesome. So I'm not too worried about this as an issue per se, except HP must be a bit peeved losing people.
Yeah. Could be.
He seems like a hardcore marketer. Like if he's done time at Visa and PepsiCo, if you've ever done time selling sugar water, then you're probably going to be able to flog anything to anyone for no apparent reason.
Honestly, I feel like selling sugar water is probably great training for Facebook. And Facebook certainly needs some marketing help given the beating it's taken in its public perception over the past 6 months.
Yeah, I don't. I actually think Facebook might be struggle in the Western world. It's very popular in the rest of the world. So that does just because it slows down in the US and Europe. Doesn't mean the end of it, but I do suspect that Facebook's core business is probably dead over time.
I don't know if I'm going to say it's dead, but it's certainly taken a hit. I know just, you know, anecdotally, I'm talking to a lot of people in my own circles who are like, no, I never go on Facebook anymore, which is exactly what Facebook doesn't want to hear.
So. No, I think a lot of people have stopped bothering. And I think increasingly what's going to happen is governments are going to come in and put laws and regulate it. And that's going to put a lot of costs
onto Facebook's.
Yes, exactly. And that's going to happen worldwide. Europe probably start out here in the UK and in Europe. And then eventually, and even the US government is talking about how they can regulate, not treat these companies as media companies. And increasingly, we're seeing politicians talk about how do we tax these companies? They have to pay taxes in the country where they're earning revenue. And so if you start putting rules on them in terms of, you know, forcing them to police themselves and content and so, you know, legal obligations to act a certain way, and then you actually start adding taxes, then all of a sudden Facebook's business model looks very weak.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Well, we'll see what happens. All right, we've reached our last sip. This is our final story for the episode. SpyPhone, this is a software company that sells spyware to track smartphone usage of family members and employees so you can see exactly what they're up to on their phones. They have exposed photos, audio recordings, email, and other data on more than 2,000 customers because of an insecure S3 bucket.
There was a post written this week which offended a whole bunch of cloudies because it was saying that a lot of enterprises are actually pulling out of the cloud because it's insecure. They're not saying, in my opinion, that the cloud is insecure. What they're saying is we can't make it secure. So if you're somebody who's been doing security around enterprise IT for 10 years and then you move into the cloud, do you have the necessary skills and people and mindset to do cloud security? And the answer is, if you don't, then maybe you need to pull back and start thinking about how you redo that with safely and securely, right? So,
I think part of the issue is that with the cloud, it's not just your security people or your networking people or your IT people who are getting access to these services. It's anyone in your organization who can essentially start using these services and fill them up with all kinds of visiting data and may have no idea how to do the proper configuration. That's an issue.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're used to securing your infrastructure using firewalls and suddenly you're in the cloud,
right, and it's not behind a firewall anymore.
And then how hard is it to then start, you know, you might just say, well, we'll go in there and we'll work it out, right? We'll just get there and work it out later. And all of a sudden you realize that that's actually not a very good idea. So maybe you pull back out of the cloud while you have another go, while you come back and start thinking to yourself, well, I'll pull it back into in-house, we'll cancel that project and then start thinking about how we can solve that problem. And then the question is, how do the cloud companies make it possible for enterprise companies to cross the chasm?
Yeah, and maybe some more sort of automatic seatbelt kind of controls to make things a little bit more locked down by default might be a good idea.
Yes.
Which may impact usability, which is...
which affects profitability. But I do really think that if the major governments, the Western governments get together and start to say, well, look, we've been giving you guys a free ride. You've built your businesses off the back of low or no taxation. You're using all of the resources that the government gives you, but you're not putting anything back. So now we're going to tax you explicitly. That's going to upset a lot of their businesses and their share prices. And that is actually where we're at because the government's being forced to do both because once they get into the crosshairs, the lumbering system of government will eventually is like a steamroller. Don't kill me. Have you ever seen that YouTube video, you know, like that somebody's running him down with a steamroller?
Yeah.
It's that sort of thing, I think.
Yes. Slow but inevitable.
Yes. And they're sort of standing there, but they can't get out of their own way. It's like, why don't you just run away from the steamroller? They're going, but we've got, you know, but you're like getting all the money before the steamroller gets you is kind of how I see it at the moment.
Right. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Where can folks get more of your analysis and inspirational cynicism?
Oh, I just call it my oeuvre. Yes, you can listen to whatever I'm doing. I quite often on Twitter bringing my unique brand of cynical inspiration to everybody and also publishing more regularly on packetpushers.net.
I'm Drew Conroy Murray. I'm also cynical. I don't know how inspirational I am, but I'm on Twitter at @Drew_CM and I'm blogging at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsor, IT Pro TV. And of course, thank you for joining us for yet another episode of Network Break. This is issue episode 199. We're going to be recording episode 200 of VMworld. That should be interesting. Anyway, if you enjoy the show, please like us on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your colleague. Check out our membership program at ignition.packetpushers.net. Welcome to Coffee Talk, a short, sharp, informative conversation from the Packet Pushers to get you up to speed on new ideas and the latest tech innovations. I'm Drew Conroy Murray. Greg Farrow is here. Our sponsor today is Silver Peak, and they've sent us a customer to talk about a real-world SD-WAN deployment. Our guest is Thomas Nice. He is Senior Network Engineer at Blue Shield of California. Thomas, welcome to the show. And to get us started, can you give us a brief background on Blue Shield of California?
Sure. Blue Shield of California is a health, dental, and vision healthcare provider. Insurance provider. We're an independent member of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, founded in 1939, and we are headquartered in San Francisco. We're a nonprofit health plan with about 4 million members and about 6,800 employees.
So biggest sort of a company, really. Have you got a lot of locations then?
About 15 locations.
Cool. So what do you do there?
In the network engineering and operations team. So we are responsible for all of the network engineering and operations tasks, kind of a twofold. we have double the responsibility.
Hey, nice. You're a health insurance provider, health insurance company.
And so you would have a WAN to support that. You'd have people littered all around the countryside accessing the core set up for that, the database servers and the application servers for that. What was the WAN architecture before you started adopting an SD-WAN strategy?
We started with a single MPLS and expanded that to a dual MPLS to provide a little more resiliency, which is basically a backup.
Was it a full mesh or a hub and spoke?
It's a full mesh.
Okay, so you would full mesh what? So sites could talk to other sites for voice and stuff like that?
Yes, for voice and file shares that were spread across different sites.
Okay, and so you wanted to be able to let anything talk to anything so that data could be shared as and when the users think. That's got some serious challenges. Do you want to talk about what are the things that caused you the most pain when running a big MPLS network like that?
There's complexity in the routing, QoS policies, because you have a data center with a really large circuit and some call center sites with fairly large circuits, but then you have all these other sites with small circuits, and you can, and especially IT users, the power users, they can really hit the WAN hard. And then, of course, there's with the dual MPLS, it's pretty much active passive.
You've always paid for two lots of bandwidth, but you only get to use one.
Right.
So is one sort of acting as a failover or a standby if the primary went down?
Yes.
So fairly traditional. And I guess it would have been fairly pricey. And so upgrading bandwidth would have been a bit of a challenge.
Certainly upgrading bandwidth would increase cost quite a bit.
Yeah. Everybody always tells me that. And that's been my experience. Like in the 20 odd years, getting extra private WAN bandwidth was always, well, pretty painful to be fair.
So what led you down the path then to SD-WAN?
So we already had Silverpeak deployed for WAN optimization, and Silverpeak came out with their new line that supported SD-WAN, and we were at a point where we could refresh. So we refreshed to the new line, mm-hmm. and we're able to deploy the SD-WAN very simply because their tool is very easy to deploy. And that way we got both benefits of WAN optimization and the SD-WAN to be able to spread the bandwidth across both circuits or utilize the bandwidth of both circuits as needed.
So you're using the WAN optimization and the SD-WAN now. Silverpeak's quite unusual here because they're one of the few companies that actually come from that WAN optimization backbone and have folded it into their WAN. And you said before about file transfers between sites. Now, WAN optimization often has a really significant performance increase for that.
Yes, and that is where we see probably the majority of our benefit with the Silverpeak is with those file transfers or file shares between sites. We can get up to 80-90% compression on some of those.
Yeah, that some of that WAN optimization stuff is quite amazing. But I imagine the fact that you're now using both MPLS pipes actually improves things quite a bit as well. So you're actually doubling the bandwidth as well as the acceleration.
Yes, it does. And one example of that is a case where we purchased another company and they needed to move a lot of information from one location to another as part of the merger. And we were able to do that with Silverpeak. Their legacy network was very small MPLS. There was no way they could move that data across their MPLS, but they had relatively large internet circuits. So we set the Silverpeak up with the ear tunnels over the internet, and we were able to transfer that information over the internet using the Silverpeak and the compression on the Silverpeak, transfer that data in a far shorter time than it would have taken over the MPLS.
I think that's a key feature of SD-WAN, and I know we've talked about that a lot on the podcast over the last 3 or 4 years, is the fact that SD-WAN can run over any bandwidth, be it MPLS or internet, you know, or any type of layer, whatever the medium is. It could be Ethernet delivered off a mainline circuit, or it could be over DSL or anything. Actually makes a substantial difference to how easily you can use this product.
Yes, and that is, I think, one of the key benefits to it.
You've used Silverpeak to solve some of your network challenges. You know, you sort of sound like you're a bit bandwidth constrained. You've done some work on the internet. Do you think you're going to replace the MPLS with internet connections over time, or is that a step too far for now?
That's a possibility in the future. I know with contracts and everything the way they are, we are somewhat locked into the MPLS for a little while. But I think that's coming down the road.
And the applications have, you know, what sort of improvements do you see? I know that the WAN acceleration was there in the first place. So just switching to SD-WAN, I'm suspecting you saw some substantial improvements.
We were in the process of migrating data centers, and we would have to, when they needed to move a large chunk of data, we'd have to, you know, create a bunch of special routing rules and QoS policies to steer that replication traffic over the backup circuit, and so that the primary circuit remains free for production use. And with SD-WAN, that's so much simpler. It's
Oh, so you were using some policy-based routing to send it over the backup link for the sync traffic so it didn't interfere with the primary day-to-day stuff?
Basically, yes.
Yeah.
And with the SD-WAN, it's literally just change a policy, mm-hmm. couple clicks, and you're done. And all that traffic can can ride on both circuits without interfering, or you can direct it all over if you want.
Yeah, I would think that the load balancing would work best because you'd be sharing it across any bandwidth that's available rather than dedicating it to one circuit or the other, because users aren't necessarily sucking up all the traffic all the time, all the bandwidth all the time.
Right, and with Silverpeak's SD-WAN, they also have QoS and shaping policies that can be applied so that you prioritize your production traffic over that replication traffic.
So can you talk a little bit about, you mentioned a couple of clicks to set up this policy. What would it have been like doing it the old way before you moved into SD-WAN?
The old way was to set up static routes for the specific /32 devices and to go over the alternate route. And then you'd have to leak those routes out because their aggregation was. And then you'd have to QoS that as well so that during the day they couldn't possibly overrun anything. So it was a lot of work.
Yeah, it is. I'm just having a shiver of just how hard that would be and how nervous you'd be when you're implementing it. But the other flip side of this is SD-WAN failover. A lot of people have talked to us about the success of SD-WAN as a much more reliable way of failing over between circuits. Are you seeing that?
Absolutely. I've even noticed. So one of the methods of failover is setting up your traffic to take the best path, and the best path is constantly being measured, right? So, and if the best path changes, then it automatically fails over to the other path, which is now the new best path, right? And I've watched as traffic bounced back and forth between our circuits as one circuit became a better path than the other, with like every 15 minutes.
But that's not affecting performance or user perception of performance?
And users had no idea. Uh-huh. And I wouldn't have even had any idea had I not been watching it.
And even though you've lost half your bandwidth, the performance is probably still good. Again, because SD-WAN does the quality of service stuff properly, it's still managed correctly. So the core business app was still functioning correctly, I'm betting.
Oh, yes. Had there been any issue, we would have heard about it. Uh-huh. And there was no issue because Silverpeak took care of it.
Yeah. Yeah, so I want to ask, you mentioned you hadn't heard about it because if there's a problem, people let you know. But have you also had people come to you and say, my file transfers are faster, or I'm experiencing more performance, or is it just, it's all quiet, it's all good?
It's kind of a no news is good news situation. Mm-hmm. The users don't really come and say, hey, we noticed that our file transfer is faster. But the kind of good thing about that is Silverpeak has measurements for that as well. They have a measurement that tells you how many hours you're saving. Well, this is on the compression side, I suppose, but it's how many hours you're saving waiting for data because of the compression and dedup. And that has been as high as 100 hours per month before, which is significant.
Yeah, Silverpeak had a great reputation for WAN optimization, and now they've taken that and just moved it into SD-WAN. And I've been through some of their presentations, and the technology behind that really remains impressive, I think. And for those people for whom acceleration works really well, it's just something. One of the things a lot of people who are doing SD-WAN talk about is local internet breakout, that is actually letting edge, instead of trunking the internet back to the core data center and then taking it out to the internet, you actually go directly from the branch straight out to the internet, and that saves a lot of WAN bandwidth. Is that something you've been considering?
It's something we're looking at. We're not doing it currently. There's security aspects right now that kind of require us to send everything through the data center. But that is something that we're looking at for specific applications.
It will take time for you to transition into that sort of a mode. I'm guessing your business is highly regulated, and you have to be careful about what you do.
Yes.
The other thing about SD-WAN is this centralized monitoring. So you actually have this central console. You could see all of the sites coming together. And sometimes that people talk about having visibility and control in that, and sometimes it's just about the monitoring. Has that been something that's lifted your day out of the doldrums of hoping things are working?
It certainly makes things much easier to configure. Having that centralized spot to configure the Silver Peak's from is a night and day difference. I don't even know what to say about it, really. It's great.
So you've never had sort of like a centralized monitoring tool before to see what's happening in the WAN, and now you do?
We have a tool called SolarWinds, which is a kind of a centralized monitoring, but not, it doesn't quite give the same level of detail. For instance, with the Silver Peak orchestrator, you can quickly and easily see what your latency is in between any two sites. That's something that didn't exist before. You can use ping and kind of get an idea, but that's nowhere near as accurate. Silver Peak is constantly measuring the latency based on the actual traffic that's going through it.
And also shows it to you per application too.
You can look at it per application.
Yeah. Instead of just saying, oh, my circuit's running at, 10 milliseconds of ping, you can actually look at application latency and say this application, this latency, oh, that's okay because I've deprioritized it. So it's supposed to have lower latency than my core business application. And you can actually see that because when you do SD-WAN, you're actually doing application inspection at the edge, which I think is really interesting. So let's talk quickly about the business benefits so the people who are listening can understand what are the key business benefits you think that you've realized from getting a Silver Peak Edge Connect deployment in place?
I think some of the key benefits is faster deployment, which equates to less time waiting on network, right? And a faster ability to turn up a branch site.
Yeah. And then, of course, you've got the failover. I think you're also saving money because you're now using up the extra bandwidth as well, which strikes me as something I'd be putting in my next salary review.
Yeah, there's definitely some aspect of a lower cost there because we are not having to increase the bandwidth. At one point, we were looking at doubling the bandwidth at all of our sites, but we haven't had to do that because of bandwidth savings and ability to utilize both circuits.
So you haven't been able to save money per se, but you've certainly been able to improve performance and delay any future bandwidth upgrades.
Yes.
And you can take that back to the business and say, look, we haven't had to go out and buy more bandwidth because of this.
Definitely a benefit. It's actually a benefit I hadn't really thought of. So that's something I'm going to bring up at our next meeting.
That's right. Yeah, don't let that go to waste.
Don't let that go. You did that. That's exactly.
Right. All right. Well, that wraps up this edition of Coffee Talk. Thank you, Thomas, for your time and your insight. And thanks to Silver Peak for sponsoring today's episode. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.